From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Love among the ancient Greeks. Following last week's discussion about aspects of that topic, Soundings now presents part two in a series of conversations about gender and sexuality in classical antiquity. Was there an ideology of sex in classical Athens? In what ways would it differ from our own? With respect to marriage, the status of women, child-rearing, and family, how did the ancient Greeks differentiate between nature and culture? Finally, how does the study of classical antiquity increase contemporary understanding of sexuality? Those questions are central to the following Soundings discussion. The Soundings panelists are Froma Zeitlin of Princeton University and Jean Hagstrom of Northwestern University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Jean Hagstrom worked on a forthcoming study about aspects of love in Western culture. Both Froma Zeitlin and Jean Hagstrom were participants in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center entitled Love, Marriage, Friendship, and Sexuality in Antiquity. Here is Froma Zeitlin.
I think that it's important to make clear that in dealing with a culture which is dominated by male values, that the kinds of documentation which have come down to us have very little to tell us specifically about the private lives of women. That is, what did women say among each other? And when we find those kinds of representations, such as comedy and tragedy, for example, on the Greek, on the Athenian theatrical, and the Athenian theater, then we are basically still getting male versions of what they imagine women say when they're alone. And I think that it's important, therefore, to recognize how much is filtered through the male mentality.
Before I draw Jean Hagstrom into the conversation, let me put a 50-cent word on the table here from Zeitlin. Feminism, was there such a thing amongst Greek women? How did it exist, and what did it consist, and what kinds of distinctions would we have to make as you look at a word like that?
Feminism is a modern word.
Uh-huh.
It has been used...
A modern word or a modern concept?
Well, it's a modern word as well.
Uh-huh.
To have an ism tends to be more of a modern word than
okay.
to say feminism. And I think that it certainly has been used, for example, in relation to Aristophanes' famous play, The Lysistrata, the sex strike that most people seem to have heard about,
right.
Women striking for peace. It certainly has been used about Plato's fifth book of the Republic, in which he advocates a community of women and children and insists that women can be trained as well as men and that their educational, their capacities for education are in every way absolutely equal, with just the small distinction, Plato thinks of as a small distinction, in that men are physically stronger than women.
Uh-huh.
But even then, women can go to war, and they can take part in politics, they can be trained as philosophers, and so on. That seems to me to have very little to do with what we would think of as modern-day feminism, which, for me, in any case, is certainly equal pay for equal work. That's
right.
One thing. And notion of equal promotion for equal merit. And has, I think, quite not very much to do in terms of women's own self-determination and the rights to their self-determination, which I don't think that we would find in the ancient world, well, certainly not in the Greek world. I think that to the extent that a marriage is a contract
mm-hmm.
made between two parties, and for the very largest part, I think, of Western culture, is a contract actually between the father of the bride and the bridegroom rather than the bride herself. To the extent that it exists as a means for transmitting inheritance
mm-hmm.
and has economic value, and for the legitimation of children who are born to it within that marriage, then I would say that that basic conception also exists in ancient Greece. To the extent that male and female were companions of one another, that they existed at any level of real equality with one another, I would say no. I think that part of that is very different. But then I want to know what we are measuring the standard against.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent, again, that we're thinking of Greek culture, ancient Greek culture, as part of Mediterranean culture, and that mm-hmm. Mediterranean culture still continues today with many of the same features about the very sharp division in labor, the division of roles, and even the segregation of the sexes, mm-hmm. and that any kind of mingling of the sexes that is not either among relatives within the family or between husband and wife would be put under suspicion, then I think that we're talking about a concept which would still be very recognizable today.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that is particularly curious about at least ancient Athens, and at least from Aristotle, is the notion that the bride is much younger than the bridegroom, which is something I find a very interesting point, and doesn't seem to be so in Rome. But that, for example, Aristotle prescribes 30 as the year of marriage for the male and 15 for the girl. And there's a great deal of discussion in the medical text that don't marry a girl too early. Don't marry her off before the menarche, before she starts to menstruate. There are all kinds of problems around that. It's an interesting issue in that 15 years between husband and wife is really an enormous gulf.
Mm-hmm. Jane Hacker?
Well, I think that 15 years comes out in, for example, work by Xenophon, Economicus, that is, the household. How should the household be run? She's very, very young, maybe 15, something like that. He's much older. Therefore, he acts as her instructor, her teacher. And it sounds terribly patronizing to us, but given that particular situation, it's perhaps understandable. I'd like to get back to the matter of differences within antiquity, mm-hmm. however. I think Frome is absolutely right in the description of marriage, and certainly in the notion that around the Mediterranean you have a continuity in these institutions that we shouldn't overlook. But Plutarch, and say Pliny the Younger, writing to his later wife, give some indications of an almost romantic notion between husband and wife. Plutarch talks about grace in marriage, and grace leads to love. Grace is associated with the woman.
Mm-hmm.
He uses strong words for unity, a fusion of the sexes. He doesn't often, well, he uses a word that is used for friendship too, philia, mm-hmm. As a love relationship. That had been traditional, of course. But there is a very glowing account of the superiority, at least on the in the statement of one of the interlocutors here, superiority of this type of love to other forms of love. I don't think it means that anything like a modern equality of the sexes is envisaged or perhaps even dreamt of. But within antiquity itself, there seems to be a heightening of the domestic temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think historians whom I know that Froma happens to admire, some French historians, Vernon and others, have shown a tremendous revolution in ancient Rome in such matters as these. So that you have internalized some of the values that have been associated with Western marriage in the Christian era without any direct influence mm-hmm. from Christianity.
Jane Hagstrom from Northwestern and Froma Zeitlin from Princeton. We're talking about love and friendship, sexuality, marriage in Greek culture. Froma, consider for me is it a modern notion to talk about nature, nurture?
Well, I think that the item which is closest to nature is obviously sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that it is an instinctive impulse, that it overcomes the person, that it is imperious, it demands to be satisfied, and that a great number of the rules of society, in fact, are designed to master that impulse, to control it, and to put it under in a social framework.
Now, it sounds to me like you're talking about Victorian England, not classical Greek society.
Oh, no, far from that, because I think, well, that would bring us into another issue, because it seems to me that so much about what Victorian sexuality is about is is the attitude towards women, and a great deal of pretense that upper class women, of course, had no sexual desire.
So this is an important distinction, an attitude toward one of the members of the species rather than the sexuality itself. Is that what you're
yes,
telling me?
Yes, I think that in that sense, yes, that would be very important. But sexuality is very important for Greek thought. And it's very important because it also works on a metaphorical level.
How is that? Pause on that and tell me about it.
Well, for one thing, and I think this is important to stress, that in a polytheistic system with many gods, that the gods themselves are seen as having desire. They desire mortal women, and Zeus, of course, has any number of his amours. This becomes a troubling ethical and theological problem for the Greeks when they begin to think about family structures, imitation of gods as models for themselves, by contrast to natural forces which overcome them. For the Greeks, Aphrodite, the goddess of carnal desire, and Eros, which is a very incarnation of that sexual impulse, are gods. And the reason that they're gods is because the Greeks divinize whatever seems to them to have immense power and to be enduring, to both power and eternity. And from that point, we can see from the mythological system the power that's given to sexuality and the role of sexuality in human life. The deepest fear that the Greek male had is to become feminized.
Could I ask from a question here?
Jane Hagstrom here.
Could I mention, because you did mention myth, what do you think about the myth of the Amazons? I know old Beethoven in the last century believed that they actually existed somewhere in Asia Minor. I think Engels, maybe Marx, I'm not sure about Marx, took that over. Chairman Mao certainly believed that there had been in ancient China a period of female domination, which would explain the tremendous male-centeredness of Confucianism, leading then, of course, to the synthesis in modern China, in Mao's China, of men and women, the equality of men and women. How do you feel about that myth? Was it a male-created fantasy only? Was there any reality behind it? I know it's not exactly a modern idea that there is a reality behind all myths. We're psychologically perhaps more sophisticated about how men at least can spin their fancies these days. But do you have any feeling about that, Froma?
Well, Gene, I'm very glad you asked me this question because people always seem to get around to the Amazons. The Amazons exercise a perpetual fascination.
Why?
Partly because of the power of the role reversal. There's a certain titillating effect to imagine things as being other than they are.
Okay.
And, of course, you should also remember that these myths eventually always have them women defeated by males, and it's by Greek males. The great hero Theseus, the great hero Heracles seems to be an obligatory exploit to at least bring back the girdle of the Amazon or the Amazon queen. As far as historicity, and I don't think we probably have time to go into that, I mean, certainly we must say that there are any number of places in Asia Minor which are called Amazonias, and they are named after them. The fact that there may be examples of women warriors and women who've been trained to fight and fight extremely well, I don't think, again, strains any of our credulity. But I think that what is particularly interesting in looking at the ethnography of the Amazons across a number of documents, from the historian Herodotus, let's say, to the much later Greco-Roman historian Strabo, is some very interesting things, is that the Amazons continually seem to move east of where you are. Wherever the sort of great settled world has been, it moves east of that.
In other words, you're talking about the unorthodox and the unconventional, that sort of thing.
Well, you're talking about more than that. What you're talking about is a blueprint in the negative for, let us say, Greek marriage. Point for point, the reversal of domesticity.
Right.
The men, if the Amazons are either a society by themselves, instead they don't rear male children, or they hamstring them so that they can't be fighters. They use men as studs, and then discard them. Or if they allow men to live with them, then the men do the women's role often. And the women, of course, refuse to have anything to do with household tasks. So that the word Amazon itself I've been several kind of several etymologies for explaining the word, and one, the most famous one, is they had only one breast. If they had cauterized the breast, so that they could then, they were always known as archers and,
right,
and horsewomen, as equestrians, that they could shoot on horseback and do it much better without having the offending breast in the way. But another meaning is a word named madza, which means bread. So the Amazons are those who are not connected with bread making, and in Greek ideology, which is so built around the interrelationship of sacrifice, which regulates relations between gods and humans, and marriage, which regulates the relationships between men and women,
right,
and within the social structure, and agriculture, which in fact regulates your landscape, and the work of the woman of plowing the fields is analogous to the husband plowing the field of the woman, in fact, to give her legitimate children.
Right.
So point for point, then, bread making is tremendously important as a sign. That is Demeter's, that is the goddess Demeter, that is what the goddess of grain, and bread and the making of bread associated with civilized life, and with very much so. So that the Amazons, also meaning those having nothing to do with bread, would also put them outside of the domestic milieu.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the concluding segment in a series of conversations about love and sexuality among the ancient Greeks. The Soundings panelists are Froma Zeitlin of Princeton University and Gene Hagstrom of Northwestern University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Gene Hagstrom worked on a forthcoming book about aspects of love in Western culture. Both Froma Zeitlin and Gene Hagstrom were participants in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center entitled Love, Marriage, Friendship, and Sexuality in Antiquity. According to Froma Zeitlin and Gene Hagstrom, male and female existed in the classical Athenian mind as polarities, separating the sexes politically and ideologically in the uses and ends of power. Since an essential element of competition infused classical Greek culture, this binary arrangement underscored Greek notions about self-esteem, marital love, and companionship. Here is Gene Hagstrom.
Earlier forms of power in Greek mythology, at least as expressed by Hesiod, do show a period of female domination in a way. The masculinization of the heavens came with Zeus and with subordinate female deities. Women often were given power, but they were boyish virgins if they got power and strength. Other women had power too, but highly limited. What do you make of the fact that much early mythology is chthonic, that is, of the earth, feminine, and that you have remnants of that in some of the rites later on, in the Maenads, in the notion of female wildness that needs taming, and so on. So it's not just the matter of one somewhat eccentric myth, like that of the Amazons, but at least according to one of the great mythographers of antiquity, a whole movement, isn't there, toward a kind of masculinization or masculine control?
Well, Gene, I think what you're saying is very interesting, because the Greeks are so persuasive, and that is why they exercise such power over us, and they've imprinted our imagination with such powerful archetypes, precisely because they make us fall into their trap, as if posing the world as the way it was, or the way it should be, whether it's Freud or it's Bachofen, whom you mentioned about the notion of motherite as being before any notion of masculine domination. And the text that you're referring to, Hesiod's Theogony, is certainly no earlier than the 7th century BC. That does not take us back to any kind of primordial time. It is the Greeks' version, which posits something before the status quo, before Zeus comes to power and the Olympian order takes over, is to posit a developmental sequence which passes, it seems to pass, certainly from the primacy, at least of earth and woman, ultimately to the primacy of the male. And what is so extremely interesting in the trajectory that one gets from Uranus, the first god, the sky, to Kronos, the middle term, and finally Zeus, is a real trajectory from the fact that that Uranus is castrated by Earth for refusing to allow children to be born. And Zeus, of course, as most people know, produced Athena himself fully armed from his head. Right. So there's certainly, one can also speak in this in respect of a great deal of womb envy. This, of course, is a version of their own past in a mythological version, but which I think that in terms of trying to reconstruct a history or history of the Bronze Age, we'll be on very, very difficult ground and too complex a problem to discuss fully here. What I'd like to stress, however, is my certain uneasiness I have in talking about woman, because I think that we have to distinguish, first of all, at least age, status, and class. We must speak about the difference between girls as children, and certainly about, or pre and adolescents, brides, those who are certainly, let's say, adolescents, virgins before marriage, brides, and especially up to the first child, or when they have children, and certainly the power of the mother. And what you're reflecting and talking about how the Greeks saw that it was, is something about seeing the power that the mother has, which says something also in the way that myth speaks to us with such a highly charged symbolic language, is that in fact that mothers do have power. Mm-hmm. And that the interesting thing in terms of the woman's role, by contrast to the male role, is that the woman, as an adult woman, has in fact is caught in a kind of double bind between the maternal role in which she has power over her children, and in the wife role in which she's asked to be subservient to the husband, and to the fact that most cultures, and especially Greek culture, have a great deal of difficulty in imagining how mothers can be sexual. And in controlling wives' sexuality. When I speak about the power that I think that Greek culture has had as sort of founding in Western culture, it's to draw our attention to it as a cultural construct and not as a given and not as a series of truths which we can vouch for. I want to get away from that reverential notion of the Golden Age or of the glory that was Greece to say, look, this is a culture which has had power because it has had certainly power to create images of a complex reality. If you want to ask what I think is the most powerful aspect of it, is this way of refusing to have things come down just on the side of good or bad or of a high prescriptive, but to be able to problematize, to be able to question and to probe. I think that this was part of the mode of Greek culture, which is very preoccupied with thinking, with categorizing, with getting things straight, and with expressing itself. It's a highly verbal and articulate culture, as well as a highly representational culture in terms of art, as well as geometry of mapping the space. So I don't want to give the impression at all that I think that by saying that we should acknowledge what we see in this culture is to resist the idea that here is the place to go for great truths. I think that has been the trap which we have fallen into, and Freud fell into it, and Beethoven fell into it. The Platonists fall into it. Foucault, in this recent book, they just fall into it in the same degree. But certainly, is trapped by Plato almost immediately. The discourse is so powerful, it is so compelling, and it's very hard to climb out of it and to take that kind of stance and that kind of distance.
Let's conclude our conversation. Froma Zeitlin from Princeton and Gene Hagstrom from Northwestern. What then should we make of our modern notions of Greek sexuality? You're at the Humanities Center participating in a conference on love and friendship and marriage, sexuality. Froma?
Well, I would just say that I think that what is very important about Greek culture is that it does speak about issues that that are of importance to us, that in the current climate, it is possible to speak of Eros, for example, which was not a subject which was studied in classical culture very much in the preceding generations, as one might imagine.
True, true. Yeah.
So
here,
I think here. That this is a way in which even the bawdy obscenities of Aristophanic comedy like the Lysistrata, which can be discussed and they can be understood and they can see what are the particular concepts that are work here, gives us a way, in fact, of opening up an area of inquiry. And I want to say that the Greeks posed questions. what I think is important about what they do is that they pose the questions, and that we should always resist thinking that they have answered the questions, or that they have some special claim on these questions more than any other, and more than any other culture. And I think that what I think is important about these aspects of Eros is to remind ourselves that the Cupid that we know from the Valentine, who is an innocuous cherubic darling with his little bow and quiver of arrows, was for the god, for the Greeks, a god that started off as a rather bearded fellow, who did grow, it's true, progressively younger as Eros became progressively playful. But it is the notion of the arrow that strikes to the heart of the other, then to Eros that takes away the wits and sweeps away the, and takes away the whip, the, excuse me, takes away the wits and rushes over one like a mountain torrent, that it is Eros, which is an uncontrollable and irresistible force. A society that has a strong reality testing factor in that it says, you don't want to give in to this. You don't want to give up your autonomy. You don't want to give put yourself, in fact, in the power of the other. That being in love is a state that is both enormously pleasurable and at the same time extremely dangerous and menacing. So that in that sense, the dangers of Eros, which is certainly that they have also posed, and that I think is of immense, perhaps immense importance to recognize that they again have imprinted us with certainly some of these important ways of thinking about a phenomenon which is still very little understood.
May I add one thing?
Jane Hagstrom.
It seems to me that some of the unsolved problems in Greece are of great importance to us, too.
Such as?
Whether one can be individually loving, caring, submitting oneself to Eros in whatever situation, and at the same time be a civic person, be a public-spirited person, whether you can be gentle enough, in a sense, to make a creative contribution to a community in which you have to yield some of your individuality, and at the same time, along with that, develop a strong relation with another. Now, I'm not sure that the Greeks completely solved that problem. No society has, but they raise it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have the feeling that they will lower emotional temperature in order to get certain public civic virtues and direct people away from warm and absorbing, maybe even obsessive, human relationships in order to achieve certain, quote, republican, close quote, values. And I think that's enormously suggestive that Greece should have caused us to ask questions like that. But often a legacy with its unsolved problems is as important as a culture that is neatly packaged and wrapped up for us.
Mm-hmm. From a Zeitlin.
Just in the purely academic side, to take some issue with Jean here, I think that what I'm speaking about in terms of Eros is about passion and sexual desire, and desire, which is, I think, quite different than love and a durative, long-term relationship of two people caring for one another. If anything, the Greek representation of Eros is quite violent and also very evanescent.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of discussions about love and sexuality in classical antiquity. The Soundings panelists were Froma Zeitlin of Princeton University and Jean Hagstrom of Northwestern University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Jean Hagstrom worked on a forthcoming book about aspects of love in Western culture. For a cassette copy of both Soundings' discussions on love and sexuality in the ancient world, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the American philosopher George Santayana. My guest will be Henry Levinson of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond for part two in a series of discussions about love and gender among the ancient Greeks. Was there an ideology of sex in classical Athens? How does the study of classical antiquity affect contemporary understanding of sexuality? Some answers and insights from scholars from Princeton and Northwestern universities. Love Among the Ruins, Part 2, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.